Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In a world where all surviving verities, a mere handful at last count, have been questioned, this show offers the reassuring certainty of two guests in two segments. Margot McCall will talk about the culture of the Zoomer tech bros, and Susanna Glickman surveys the new merchants of death, the software warriors. In a series of articles in the San Francisco Standard, Margot McCall and several of her colleagues explore the culture of the latest iteration of the tech bro, Zoomer version, driven, ripped, nihilistic, doomy, and aiming to live forever. They won't drink, but they shoot up mysterious Chinese peptides. They think AI may kill us, but they want to make their first billion before it does. To an old-style humanist like me, they seem bizarre and terrifying. Here to tell the story is Margot McCall. She's the Standard's tech and government reporter based in Washington. Previously, she was at TechCrunch covering venture capital and startups. Margot McCall. There's a new tech bro on the digital block. They're not the socially awkward geeks of old. What's the demographic profile? How would you sketch the archetype?
Yeah, I mean, we interviewed about 24 of them. I mean, they're ripped. They're working out all the time. They're taking biohacking to sort of new heights. And they're incredibly nihilistic. A lot of the guys I talked to were like, AGI is going to take our jobs. We have 10 years until nothing matters. This is your last chance to become a billionaire.
How male is this world?
Very, very male. We purposely focused on the men just because tech bro is like such a pre-existing archetype that we kind of wanted to update. We did interview women, particularly we had like a dating story we did, and I don't think Silicon Valley has done much better on gender parity with this AI boom.
So I'm old enough to remember the dot-com boom of the 90s. It was often ridiculous, but there was a strange utopianism at its core. And then even the unicorn era, dominated by the likes of Uber and Airbnb, there was some residual utopianism there too. Although ordering a cab is less grandiose than the peace, love, and understanding vibes of 1998. But what's it like now? As you said, it seems nihilistic. That nihilism, what are the dimensions of it?
I think a lot of it is that a lot of these companies are selling directly to the government, right? Like when you had these companies that were selling directly to consumers, I think it benefited them to paint a really wonderful world. They wanted you to want to connect with others and join their social apps. They wanted to present Uber as this thing that was going to make getting everywhere so much easier and the world was going to be great. When you're selling to the government, I do not think you are nearly as incentivized to paint a rosy picture of the world when you are selling weapons or nuclear power.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not the sweet, humane side of government. It's the Pentagon mostly, right?
Lots of Pentagon sales, yes.
Palantir and Anduril and folks like that?
Palantir, Anduril, and then you have all these upstarts. You have a lot of AI companies trying to sell to the government. I mean, I've met a bunch of 21-year-olds in El Segundo that are making weaponized drones. They're making AI for weapons.
Do they have any traces of conscience about these things? I mean, no. I remember when the Google workforce rebelled at Pentagon contracts, but these guys don't care about that sort of thing?
These guys certainly don't care. I mean, they're smaller companies and they don't attract employees that care, right? Like the problem with Google is that it didn't set out to be a company that was potentially powering really dangerous things. These companies are.
And the age range, these are considerably younger than the generation they're succeeding.
Yeah, we focused on Gen Z, particularly for this article, because there's been a huge influx of young people into SF for AI.
Do they have some sort of generational consciousness about that? They're new kids. The millennials were idealistic and the roots of socialist politics, and that sort of thing. Do they not share those kinds of social attitudes?
I think it's much more of like a pragmatism. I also think, because a question we asked them was, who are your idols? And the idols they said were like Palmer Luckey, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk. When we asked their dream companies, it was Palantir, it was Anduril. Like, these are not guys that are aspiring to work at Google to be the friendly CEO that everyone loves.
Well, Google's not that much anymore either. But
I know.
So they're really obsessed with health, gym routines, supplements. They're not the cold pizza and Diet Coke guys that, the cliches of old. And no traces of the bohemianism that characterized the old tech world either, right? They're straight and narrow.
No, and none of them went to a Burning Man. That was something I was surprised by. I think I talked to one guy who did.
One guy said he had to wait to be—he's a billionaire, right?
Yeah, one guy wanted to wait to a billionaire. One guy was like, "I went as a joke." And I was like, "It's a really expensive joke.
Some of these supplements, talk about their health routines. They're wild.
Yeah, this is my first time learning about peptide injections. These guys are injecting themselves with things like Ozempic, but they're also trying other chemicals that promise to increase your energy, to help you lose weight. And they claim it's all in pursuit of being able to work literally all the time.
996, it is working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week, originally a Chinese term that these guys have imported here. That's not enough for some of them. You say 80 to 120 hours a week. That's, you know, I'm not sure I believe the 120 hours a week, but that's 17 hours a day. There's nothing to their life besides work, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, they were huge workaholics. I mean, I wrote a dating piece because something I found was funny was that they all wanted 4 kids, but they all wanted to work. Not like none of them were on dating apps. They only spent their time working. It is definitely like, I feel like a less fun era for Silicon Valley. Like they're not doing a ton of, at least these guys were not doing a ton of psychedelics and they were really just working all the time.
There was some LSD, wasn't there? A couple of these guys?
A few founders took it for like inspiration. It's interesting because any of the ones selling to the government were like, we don't do drugs because they clearly feel they need to portray that to the government. Guys that were just working on like AI consumer apps can do whatever they want. And I think they are.
And they really have reclaimed the term tech bro. It was once sort of a slur or an insult, but now they're kind of proud of this label.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, when I talk to young people, like they want to be founders. They want to move out there and they accept the label.
And there's this rhyming pair, Riz and Tiz. Tell us about Riz and Tiz.
Yeah, that was a term by Ariel Zuckerberg, who is Mark Zuckerberg's sister, who's also an investor. And we had like a dictionary too, if any of these terms are confusing any listeners, but Riz is like charisma and then Tiz is autism, which has been branded as this really great thing for founders to have. So she's like, you need the perfect balance of charisma and autism to be a compelling founder and run a great company.
Just not too much Tiz though, right?
Just not too much Tiz, the right amount.
Part of their work is being influencers, social media. That's a way to promote themselves and also raise money, right?
Totally. I mean, I think a lot of these guys kind of came up during COVID when that was a really great way, like to be on Clubhouse, to be posting. That was a really great way to get investors' attention when a lot of in-person meetings weren't happening. And they've really ran with it. You see a lot of founders. I wrote about this founder who he does sperm racing and he's raised $10 million for these events that just go super viral.
They're obsessed with sperm motility, some of these characters, right?
Yes, which comes from Brian Johnson, who's the guy that has done everything.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he's their lodestar in some way. Tell us about Brian Johnson.
Yeah, Brian Johnson is an entrepreneur who he started this thing called Blueprint, where he has a team of doctors to spend an ungodly amount of money to kind of try to figure out how to live forever. And he is obsessed with every way of measuring your body, one of which is sperm count, sperm speed. I had to read a lot of his articles about it while I was writing this article. And these guys totally look up to him. Even though to the average person, he's almost like spooky looking. Like he looks gaunt and very off. But these guys, they claim that the biohacking is not aesthetic. It is so that they can work and live forever.
Is he the guy who's obsessed with his son's penis size?
Yes, he does. He does compare himself to his son often.
That's really weird. But yeah, the immortality thing is weird. You quote somebody saying, if you're under the age of 40, you won't die, especially if you have money. I mean, that seems certifiably insane. Do they really believe this?
I don't know, honestly. I know they believe that. I think there's like a distrust in like everything like mainstream. So like they really believe that if you go out of the mainstream medicine, that you can kind of buy your way to benefits that the average person doesn't have access to. Like they're buying these peptides from these like gray area Chinese pharmaceutical companies. I don't know if they're going to live forever, but they definitely think they can buy an advantage.
They won't have a glass of wine, but they'll buy
I know, none of them drink.
Peptides from God knows where. It's just a strange sense of safety.
Yeah, we'd ask them like, what's your favorite like bar in SF? We were going to like make a map of like their favorite spots. And like no one could name a club. And they named like 2 bars total.
Wow. But they did go back to San Francisco. I know you quote somebody saying that remote work was a psyop. They're really back into the office.
Yeah, which I think is also a result of hardware being like cool again and getting funding again, right? Like you're probably not going to have a hardware company where you have these engineers working remotely.
I'm speaking with the San Francisco Standard journalist, Margot McCall. They love Elon Musk for many reasons, I'm sure, but one of them is his philosophy of reproduction, right? What, he's got a dozen kids or whatever? That's
I don't know what the count is now.
Yeah.
So many more than we know of.
But one says, I'm not looking to marry until after AGI, artificial general intelligence. They are obsessed with AGI. They run their lives around existing AI and have dreams, some of them apocalyptic and a little frightening about what the future of AI will bring us. Tell us about the role of AI in their lives.
They use AI all the time. I mean, I talked to at least three different founders who had completely replaced Google with it. I talked to two founders that were using it for legal advice. They're like, we go to ChatGPT and then we send those answers to our lawyer to see if like we can do something. Yeah, they are really convinced that if you incorporate AI into every step of your workflow, it will only make you better.
But then it's going to transform human life, perhaps not the ideal direction.
I know. And I would ask them to define AGI, and they always had sort of like waffling answers, which was kind of interesting for something that they're very afraid of. But it's interesting because they also kind of have reason to think that AI is like going to ruin everything, because at least for like software engineer jobs, we're seeing like a huge decrease in entry-level software engineer jobs. So I think they're seeing a lot of their friends graduate from top universities and like not be able to get a job. And I think that's really feeding into this nihilism.
So they figure that you just got to hurry things up before everything falls apart.
Yeah, I also think, I mean, this was kind of the unspoken part, which is that like there's probably only so many ChatGPT rappers that can raise a ton of money and be successful. So I think they're all like, we want to be that one.
As you say, it promotes kind of this end times desperation. You quote one guy saying, this is the last chance to build generational wealth. You need to make money now before you become part of a permanent underclass. You're either a billionaire successful founder or you're living on the sidewalk. There's nothing in between.
And then I'd ask them, I'd be like, so I'm a journalist. Like, am I part of the permanent underclass? Yeah.
Well, journalism is not a field that's exactly thriving these days.
No, it's not.
Yeah, that sense that time is limited and they have to be in such a hurry. I remember being late teens, early 20s, and my attitude was, I'm of a very different generation, but my attitude was, you know, take your time, have a little pleasure in life. That just does not describe their worldview at all, does it?
No, I was talking to this very young founder. He was like 18, and I was like, oh, are you going to go to college? And he was like, I don't know. He was like, if I get into Stanford or MIT and I think that can optimize my business, then like I'll go for a year. And I was like, you need to go to a party. You need to have a drink. You need to like become a well-rounded person. Yeah.
It just makes you think, like, what does having these people write our code do? What kind of influence do they have on the larger society? Is this a marginal subculture or is this something that really is quite influential?
That's a good question. Probably pretty influential. I mean, I think you see right now we're seeing with a lot of these big LLM companies having to backtrack and add some of the social good things, right? Like OpenAI just got around to putting in like mental health checks into their code. So I think there is, and maybe has always been, this sense of move fast, break things, launch things, be a first mover and think about the consequences later.
Disrupt has been a word for a long time.
Yeah.
Politics. A lot of them are professedly apolitical, but they seem to at least comfortable with the whole culture's move to the right, the Silicon Valley culture's move to the right. And you say some even are Ayn Rand fans. So what about their politics insofar as they have any?
Yeah, that was interesting. I expected them to be a lot more openly right-wing. They would get very bashful. We'd ask every person like who they voted for. And they got very bashful. A lot of them declined to answer, which I assumed. I was like, okay, I guess that is Trump, right? That's kind of where my mind goes when someone like is shy to answer. And then it's funny because I was actually talking to a female founder for The Dating Story, and she was like, yeah, like she was like, I've had guys be embarrassed to say they voted for Kamala. And I was like, huh. Maybe they're all left. And we're ashamed to admit that now.
Wow. But yeah, there are some Ayn Rand fans among them.
Yeah. Something I think about a lot with these guys is like, I think classifying them as like right or left kind of misses the point. I think they are like foundationally like techno optimists, right? Like they just truly believe that Silicon Valley can do the function of government in a lot of aspects a lot better. And I think that guides a lot of their kind of worldview.
But techno optimism would sit uneasily with the kind of nihilism that also seems to suffuse this world.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's that like the world's like going to hell But if you let Elon come in and slash government budgets, maybe we have a chance, right? Like they're selling the sliver of hope.
I guess they're too young to be able to afford their bunker in New Zealand, though.
True.
Nicotine patches, too. You know, you'd think that nicotine is the ultimate thing in unhealthiness. They don't smoke, but they wear nicotine patches.
I know. That was one of the craziest things for me. I talked to at least three or four guys that took nicotine as like a supplement, like the way you take like vitamin C in the morning. They would slap on a nicotine patch and they'd say it helped them focus, which actually, when I looked into like the science behind it, there are a few studies that indicate that nicotine for retaining like memory function can be very positive, although it's very experimental. Listeners don't do this.
Yeah, it's also an insect poison.
Yeah.
And sleep. Obviously, if you're sleeping, you can't be working. So how do they deal with those enforced hours of unconsciousness?
Yeah, I mean, they just measure it. They all have 8 sleeps. They all, you know, wear Oura rings. They will track their sleep and try to quantify their sleep however possible.
And the Neurode headband, what's that all about?
The Neurode headband. Yeah. Oh, that's the ADHD thing.
Yeah.
I cannot speak intelligently on the science behind it. But
it's supposed to do what?
It's supposed to help you with focus, and it's supposed to be sort of a non-medicinal treatment for ADHD.
Coding. You mentioned this earlier. Coding is not the thing that it used to be, with Claude now writing so much of it. What's taken its place in their lives? What are they doing now? What's the focus of their work life?
They still code. They just use these AI assistants to do a lot of the work for them. And they hire smaller teams, which I find really interesting, which has led to like a decrease in jobs in Silicon Valley at large. So coding's still important. They just really believe that AI will be able to do a lot of it.
Finally, does this strike you as a sustainable mode of life and one that most people wouldn't find weird, maybe even repellent?
I had one of the tech bros ask me, he was like, what advice would you give to my founder friends who are struggling with dating? And I told them, maybe they should try liking something just a normal amount, like work out like a normal amount, be into health a normal amount, smoke a cigarette, you know, maybe don't slap on a nicotine patch for focus.
Yeah, the dating life, they just don't date at all?
They don't really date at all. I mean, they're just not on dating apps. They all want to be married. They all want kids. They've all kind of embraced a bit of like the trad values in that sense, but they're just not really doing anything about it.
I mean, I don't want to engage in gender cliches, but I'd imagine that most women would find this life pretty bizarre and not one they'd want to be part of.
Maybe. I think that Silicon Valley is so self-selecting because I talked to some very brilliant female founders that were also doing biohacking stuff. Like the founder of that AI headband is a woman. They are interested in dating men that are as like passionate about tech as them. They're like, we don't even know where to like meet them. Like these guys aren't even going out. And like, there is an element of like normal human interaction these men have to engage with to like meet a woman.
So the tech women can have more normal lives than the boys.
I mean, I don't know. Cause like I have met women in Silicon Valley that do this. There's just less of them, right?
What a world. So did you get any reaction from these people after your articles appeared?
Yeah, I did. Most of them really liked it. There were a few of like the dating quotes where guys were like, damn, maybe I should not have gone on the record saying that. it was mostly benign. I think that we successfully captured something that we were set out to capture of the culture of these new, very odd tech bros.
And they don't feel at all odd about their, they don't feel at all odd, do they?
No, I think if anything, saying these things and having these things in an article probably helps their investment chances. I think investors like guys that are really have the riz and the tiz.
Do the VCs feel warmly towards this this culture?
Yeah. Having a founder that works 996 and optimizes their body for the sake of working more, that's great.
Yeah, it sounds like it's great for your return.
Yeah.
That was Margot McCall, a reporter for the San Francisco Standard. The Standard, a news site focusing on Bay Area news, was founded in 2021 with money from Michael Moritz, whose politics looked to be quite to the right of mine. Moritz started life as a journalist, but in 1986 he transformed himself into a venture capitalist, joining Sequoia Capital, from which he accumulated a fortune now estimated by Forbes as over $7 billion, putting him at number 218 on their list of Richies. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Now, I'm a feller with a heart of gold, with the ways of a gentleman, I've been told. The kind of a feller that wouldn't even harm a flea. But if me and a certain character met, the guy that invented the cigarette, I'd murder that son of a gun in the first degree. Now, it ain't cause that I don't smoke myself, and I don't reckon they hinder your health. I've smoked them all my life, and I ain't dead yet. But nicotine slaves are all the same at a petting party or a poker game. Everything's gotta stop while they have that cigarette.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you smoke yourself to death.
Tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you hates to make him wait, but you just gotta have another cigarette.
That was some of Smoke, Smoke, Smoke by Tex Williams from 1947. Next, the new crop of military contractors and the subclass that leads them. The topic of a fascinating article in the New York Review of Books by Susanna Glickman. Arms contracting in the U.S. is now dominated by five giant firms, the product of years of mergers, known as the Primes, short for Prime Contractors. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, and RTX, formerly Raytheon. Their dominance was attacked in an article by Shyam Sankar, a senior executive of Palantir, which aims, in classic Silicon Valley style, to disrupt the rule of the primes. Sankar posted it to a site called 18theses.com, a nod to Martin Luther, who had 77 more theses when he launched the Protestant Reformation in 1517, but who's counting? Also in classic Silicon Valley style, Sankar calls for junking the giant firms in favor of a return to the alleged entrepreneurial style of old, ignoring the fact that Palantir was founded with and survives on government money. Same with Palantir's younger cousins like Anduril, yet another tech firm like Palantir with a name derived from Lord of the Rings. Susanna Glickman is here with more. She's an assistant professor of history at Stony Brook University. Glickman has a background in math as well as history. Her undergraduate thesis at Reed College was on optimal queries for the dihedral hidden subgroup problem, which sounds to me like a communication from an alien civilization. I'm in awe of people to whom that makes sense. Susanna Glickman. A year ago, Shyam Sankar of Palantir posted an article with concerns about consolidations in the arms sector, leading to oligopoly and stagnation, a product of decades of mergers that have left us with just five giant prime arms contractors. At times, he sounded almost like Lena Khan or Matt Stoller, but this is a view shared by many of his colleagues in a new coterie of tech-centered firms. So what's their argument? What is the problem? How'd we get here?
Naomi Klein's recent book, Doppelganger, they do adopt these left-wing sounding critiques of real existing problems that have not been addressed by either existing party. There's sort of two paths through which a kind of anti-neoliberal critique of defense and national security has emerged. One of those paths, right, is sort of one that's more probably more familiar to you and me. It's left-wing academia has for a long time, you know, especially in anthropology, but also history, sociology, a number of other fields has developed a critique of neoliberalism and the demise of like the welfare state that I think probably your listeners are pretty familiar with. But there's another critique that came up alongside it that has its origins in the sort of productive industries around defense, like the traditional defense industry, but also chip manufacturers, and they're less powerful, but the chemical industry that also critiques the anti-productive implications of neoliberal policy. In the 1980s, the semiconductor industry first underwent a series of crises stemming from defense cuts and other shifts in American productive industries that have been happening for a while. So textiles started offshoring in the 60s, and then a number of industries followed. And at the same time, Japan became a very competent producer of high-tech goods, increasingly threatening the American model of capitalism, right? By being able to produce high-tech goods cheaper, faster, and better, it produced this real anxiety in American elites, and especially these productive industries, that like maybe American capitalism wasn't the best model. So the semiconductor industry responds to that, asks for all these things from government, you know, starts lobbying Washington in the early 1980s as they get pummeled. And I think at the same time, as Reagan relaxes a lot of the regulations around financial capital, we get the rise of these corporate raiders that now we know as private equity firms. You get a new theory of the firm that emphasizes fiduciary duty to stockholders. Juicing stock values becomes a bigger part of corporate life. There's a number of other changes that happen at the same time. But what this all produces is a very hostile environment for productive industries. The semiconductor industry feels it first, most acutely, and then defense industries experience like a similar set of very existential problems even before the Cold War ends. So they begin to develop, beginning in the 80s, but through the 90s, this critique of financialization, of this theory of American decline that I think ends up by the mid-2000s sounding a lot like the left-wing critique and is taken up by people like the new defense techs.
While this is self-serving, there is some truth to Sankar's indictment. These are lumbering firms with guaranteed profits and a habit of producing overpriced weapons that don't work very well. There is something to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think anyone would deny that the defense industry, the traditional defense primes, have huge problems and that the defense industrial base is in a bad situation, right? But it's not separate from the rest. We sort of imagine there's this artificial separation between defense industries and the rest of the economy. But it's true for all productive industries that the way we've structured our economy is really disadvantaged producers. For instance, you mentioned monopolies, right? Defense monopolies have actually produced all of these issues in defense. So inferior products, right? Yeah, the same kinds of issues that stem from monopolies generally, right? The U.S. doesn't have, you know, other places to turn than the primes. It's not that they're wrong about the troubled nature of the industry. It's just that their solutions are sort of false solutions to this problem of like costly, dysfunctional weapon systems that are not suited to addressing current challenges.
Ludicrously, Sankar in that article compares the Defense Department to communist Cuba. These are like the two remaining bastions of communism in the world. It's just like these people are surreal sometimes.
It's a pretty incredible comparison. The defense industry has a lot of problems. The primes themselves would agree with that. But the solutions that they offer are too easy and too self-serving. And this is kind of what Obama thought too, right? If we just switch out these lumbering, corrupt, bloated, monopolistic defense primes with another set of monopolies, namely tech monopolies that are, you know, at the time they were aligned with Democrats. But if you don't change the fundamental structure of the economy, the fundamental structure of the industry, you're not going to get a different outcome. You just get a different set of companies that have the same issues or they're worse. And in this case, I think, you know, for various reasons, they may be worse than the primes.
Sankar also makes some grand claims about how displacing this oligopoly and replacing it with people like him will lead to a broader industrial revival, which is a very grand claim. I don't see how replacing Lockheed Martin with Palantir is really going to have much of an effect on the rest of us.
They have this idea, software-driven reindustrialization. We should leverage American excellence in software. That is the competitive advantage that we have. And if we just put software in everything, right, this Internet of Things idea that isn't particularly new, we could optimize all of these different systems. They're thinking a lot about AI, that this will precipitate a new industrial revolution, which I also don't find super credible. It sounds like the kind of speech you would give to juice your stock values rather than solve a problem.
It's working on the stock market, because I was surprised to learn in his piece that the market cap of Palantir is now higher than the combined market capitalizations of Boeing, Lockheed, and General Dynamics. You see this sort of thing all over, like Tesla being worth more than the entire auto industry and things like that.
But right.
It's just delusional. The faith that people have in the future of software to remake everything is it's a remarkable thing to behold.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, especially because a lot of these companies like Palantir, Anduril are getting hardware contracts. And the way that they're structured and the sort of political economy of Silicon Valley, I think, is not particularly well suited to defense. You know, move fast and break things. And by that, right, they mean like stripping oversight, breaking some laws here and there, skirting around. A lot of tech companies are not creating products that are radically, you know, transformative so much as they're able to sort of get around existing laws. It's more legal innovation than it is technological innovation. whatever the merits or demerits of that model for like civilian industry, to bring that into defense seems potentially catastrophic. A lot of these firms are, and their funders, right, are structured to maximize flows of capital rather than building things. This venture capital model prioritizes, you know, juicing a company to its IPO and then getting out and getting your value there rather than actually like building something. They've also, since defense has become more of a profitable industry, a lot of financial vehicles that exist in Silicon Valley have moved toward defense. So like private equity, which works in a lot of different fields, has increasingly invested in defense. Their model, what they do is they buy companies, they tend to saddle them with lots of debt, pay themselves out large salaries, and then they look for inefficiencies and restructure the firm. But what ends up happening is these inefficiencies tend to be things that stabilize the companies over the long term. So they make very short-sighted decisions that then in the long term break the company or like make it less resilient in various ways. But it looks like they're saving money in the short term, and they sort of they'll sell off whatever they can sell off and basically like loot the company. Once stock values have risen, they'll get out on the other side. So this is not the kind of model that you'd want if you were invested in building weapons for the US. This is not the model that to me seems to make a lot of sense.
They trade in a mythology about the past. Back in the good old days, the defense industry, or you could say this of a lot of American capitalism, was driven by bold entrepreneurs, geniuses with some weird ideas that turned out to be correct. And this is certainly not the case in the weapons industry, which, as you put it, was all about building a new formidable state. The development of this industry was very much wrapped up with state planning, state funding, and it was just not plucky entrepreneurs that made it what it is. But they seem to think it's very important to argue that it is.
One thing that I noticed when I started studying this field that really, you know, as a historian, I was like, oh, wow. So, you know, what I do is actually really important because these guys are so invested in history. I do both archival work and interviews. And in one of my interviews, I met a founder who immediately upon meeting, he was like, oh, I knew the historians would come knocking. And I was like, I don't, you know, maybe not like you think, but they're very invested in telling a specific revisionist history of the defense industrial base and of US power and military might, right? That begins with reimagining World War II, which is like the most planned economy we've ever had, the closest we've come to socialism, as this story of founders. Sankar narrates it, you know, going back to that World War II era period and the immediate Cold War, it was founders. We think of it as Northrop Grumman and Martin Marietta, but it was Jack Northrop, Glenn Martin, and Howard Hughes, and Henry Kaiser, and even inside of government, the Kelly Johnsons, John Boyds. These are uniquely hard-headed, creative, difficult people that are required to win. And I think every startup understands that. That's what a startup looks like. So it's like retelling the entire 20th century as a hagiography of startup founders, which is completely ridiculous, right? Because the US during World War II started or revolutionized so many industries, especially industries related to defense, like the entire airline industry, aerospace, chips, right? Computing. It's all US really heavy investment, planning. They modernized all these industries that weren't up to snuff. And then, you know, through the Cold War, all of the things that built Silicon Valley came out of defense. Like I thought when I was writing my dissertation, I was writing a history of computing. And slowly over time, I've realized it's all defense. I've been writing a history of the defense industrial base. But these guys are very invested in telling a great man version of history that makes them the heroes and justifies they're running the government now. Like there was this tweet, I think, I know this is silly, but a couple, like maybe half a year ago, where this guy put it out very, very plainly. He said, Silicon Valley built the modern world. Why shouldn't we run it? That's what they really believe. It used to be leaders of industry could hold both things at once. Like they knew that they had to go to government to ask for things, right? And they knew that they relied on government, but they told a different story to the public. I trace this in my work to the semiconductor industry when, you know, they went begging to Washington in the 80s and 90s for help vis-a-vis the Japanese. They got it. it's not that they didn't do anything, right, to beat the Japanese, but they knew they required a lot of government involvement. When the new right came, ascended in the Republican Party, they were so anti-statist. They wanted to dismantle even the kinds of industrial policy that made weapons production possible. And this galvanized like a whole set of coalition building around protecting, at very least, the industrial policy for defense-related industries with mixed success, right? But enough success that the semiconductor industry was okay. The defense industry kind of hobbled along. The kind of settlement they came to with Gingrich Republicans was that they would quietly do this hidden industrial policy while publicly saying that this is a story of founders. And I think this generation has maybe lost sense. I mean, they're going to government and they're saying, you know, government needs to give us all this money. I think on some level, they truly believe it'll be fine if we destroy all of the research, support, standardization, all of the things that government does for their industry, which I think they will not be able to replace, but they seem to believe they can, in a kind of mercenary fashion, hire researchers and let them go at will. The thing is, industrial policy requires long-term, steady funding. It needs to be predictable because you can't, there's no point in investing if it's going to change in 4 years or 2 years or whatever. You can't invest without having some kind of stability and certainty that the things you're counting on will still be there.
I'm speaking with the historian Susanna Glickman. Okay, now turning to these new guys, the ones with names derived from Lord of the Rings. Palantir, Anduril, founded by Boy Wonder, Palmer Luckey. Where do these guys come from? I mean, where do these firms come from, and who is this cast of characters that produced them?
So in the effort to preserve some kind of government support and industrial policy for defense-adjacent industries like semiconductors, like the defense industry, there's all kinds of institutional experimentation. Cyrus Modi writes about this very well for the semiconductor industry in his book, The Long Arm of Moore's Law. But the defense industry, you know, a lot of them, Norm Augustine, who I write about extensively, they were very involved in the measures taken to kind of protect the semiconductor industry, and they copy their playbook. One of the things that comes out of this institutional experimentation is this technically a nonprofit, but it's an arm of the CIA, a venture capital arm of the CIA, known as InQtel. InQtel is the reason why Palantir and Anduril have succeeded, right? Because they were the first funders of Palantir, and they were their only founders from 2005 to 2008 when they tried to enter various civilian markets without much success, actually. There's an interesting BuzzFeed article about that. Yeah, so they basically not just funded them, right, but guided them, gave them an easy pathway to long-term lucrative contracts, and recommended them to other agencies, which, you know, Palantir got very involved in, like, the war on terror surveillance and national security state. So that's where Palantir specifically comes from. A bunch of these other firms have been funded by InQtel. So their success is very much bound up with government support, industrial policy, and preferential treatment.
Yeah, when I first learned the CIA had a venture capital arm, I was like really taken aback, but it's been quite influential, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, it's been very successful. Maybe not so much, you know, what I've heard in my interviews is it's not so much helpful. The original intent was, right, to bring commercial innovations and new technology into the intel community. I don't think it's been quite so successful at that from my interviews, but what it has been very successful at is starting all these new defense tech firms. They've been very financially successful, especially post-Biden and onwards. When Palantir tried to enter regular commercial markets, they actually didn't have much success during the Obama presidency.
You're right. It will require binding the state closer to a range of tech giants, especially firms like Meta, Amazon, and Microsoft that have thus far, on this view, neglected their patriotic duty to engage in defense work and profited from feminized ad tech instead. There's a gendering in this worldview that's very curious. So civilian industries are feminine and weapons are masculine. Is that the thinking?
There's definitely a lot of gender going on. Even Trump's formulation of the tariffs, right? Like there was that Fox, Trump's manly tariffs will bring back American greatness or American manhood in some way. But yeah, so the critique that a lot of these kind of defense tech and right-wing pro-industrialization folks like Julius Krein in American Affairs. And they're looking back on the Obama period, they think that those big tech companies were focused on money-making and this kind of effeminate ad tech, as opposed to, you know, building submarines, reindustrializing, being focused on America's national security. For them, the rise of China looms large for their imagination of like why that is like a huge betrayal of their purpose. It seems to me that once Amazon, Microsoft, et cetera, were sort of given permission and quashed the internal dissent around working on defense, they were perfectly happy to do it, right? They all, a bunch of their executives, you know, joined the army recently. But yeah, there is this whole gendered imagination of like what U.S. companies should be doing vis-a-vis, you know, American power and defense.
It's funny that these people are generally very scornful of what they would think of as welfare dependency. But in fact, all their money comes from government contracts. And they're now at the phase where they really have a material interest in ramping up tensions with China. They want to build more weapons. Their rhetoric is pretty different from the reality of what sustains them.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this huge divide. And I think it's very bad for democracy between rhetoric and reality. So it's not just these traditional defense tech guys, but Eric Schmidt, Marc Andreessen, and a variety of similar figures, you know, at the end of the Obama era, became very fixated on China and the Chinese threat, and that, you know, the U.S. was going to fall behind. This was the end of American power. You know, in some ways, it resembled the 1980s conflict with Japan. Now, I think it's a good time to reassess their sincerity on that. Because, you know, Biden was precisely the kind of China hawk that many of these guys wanted around tech. He did the export controls. He's very focused on supply chains and reshoring. I have critiques of how a lot of that stuff was implemented. And I also don't think that war with China is inevitable. But from their perspective, Biden delivered, whereas part of their rationale for going in on Trump was that the Democrats weren't serious enough about China and that Trump would really, you know, reindustrialize. But that all seems belied now, where Trump seems perfectly happy to sell chips to China as long as the U.S. gets 10% of NVIDIA sales, by alienating foreign partners with things like the Hyundai raid in Georgia, undermining this our ability to learn from and build alliances with other countries that would be necessary to really confront China. They've demonstrated they aren't very sincere about this and maybe were using it to juice stock values. There's that incredible quote from Thiel and Schmidt's fund, the American Frontier Fund, their VC firm, you know, where they say if the China-Taiwan situations happens, if there is a kinetic event in the Pacific, then the fund's investment will go up 10 times overnight. Like, that's what they're saying to their investors. It's very clear that that's now that Trump seems not as much of a China hawk, that that was what they were invested in instead. But they have horrible incentives, yeah.
Say what you will about Biden's industrial policy, there was something like a strategy behind it. It's hard to discern a strategy behind Trump's attempts to reindustrialize the U.S. other than, you know, whatever he whimsically comes up with on Truth Social one morning.
Yeah, I think it's pretty incoherent. I think you can't both dismantle the state and go to war with China. And it seems pretty off the cuff. I mean, Trump himself is off the cuff, but it seems like there's a lot of contradictory impulses even in, you know, the implementation, right, of his policy. As they're talking about industrialization, reindustrialization, they're dismantling the means through which they might do that.
I was struck by this one quote from somebody in the field. If you want daily software upgrades, you've got to pay software margins. I imagine some grunt on the battlefield turning on his howitzer and finding it in the midst of a software update. But firms like Palantir would retain control of the software, and the government would not own it, which is very bizarre for government work generally, but especially for military work, which you think they'd want tight control over. So they're really turning over control of much of the military enterprise to this new generation of contractors.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this seems designed for long-term rent-seeking. I mean, that's basically Palantir. That's how they gained market share, right? You know, from what I can tell, it seems like one of the things that they're very good at is taking in a lot of data and making it very hard to export or move to another system. This isn't uncommon. This is how tech companies often build value, is creative long-term rent-seeking. But it also, you know, it's something that should alarm us. during the Bush administration, there was plenty of privatization that had really bad outcomes, right? Like we think about Blackwater, but also in the piece, there's this great anecdote from this, I think, Green Beret, who talks about how they outsourced, he said he had a truck that had a vent rod. These trucks that were driving around, these MRAPs, require a contractor to come in and work on it to fix anything. And they were an area that they'd been shot at. He had to medically evacuate some guys, and the contractors didn't want to come to them. So they were forced to drive through, you know, this war zone, hundreds of kilometers, where the contractor could repair it, right? And this Green Beret reflects on that by thinking all this capacity that existed within the U.S. military shifted over to the private sector. And they had control and some sort of veto power over whether the U.S. state could do the things that it needs to do. This is taking that to another level, right? So you're not just contracting out the sort of fundamental capability, but you're also contracting it out in terms of like software as a service, right? It means that in the moment, they can just turn things off. It gives them even more veto power over U.S. foreign policy. Or you can imagine domestically as well, right? Often these defense material ends up back in U.S. police departments, exercised on, you know, our own population, and giving these guys control over all these systems seems like a real problem. It's already been a real problem.
And it's not just defense. Palantir and these characters are all over Trump's war on immigrants, the deportation machinery. You quote ICE's director as saying he wanted his agencies to run like Amazon Prime with human beings, which is a strikingly callous statement. They're really all over this surveillance of civilians and not just battlefields.
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible quote. And, you know, what gives Palantir here, again, the competitive edge is they don't seem particularly worried about, like the administration, about breaking, you know, U.S. privacy laws. that's the tech edge is sort of legal innovation rather than technological innovation. It is a pretty horrifying horizon. But also, you know, going back to the sort of long-term rent seeking, you know, the U.S. defense industry relies a lot on exports, unfortunately, but it's really going to undermine that as well, right? Because partners will look at Palantir and Anduril and their political bent and say, you know, do I really want these guys to have the ability to turn off my weapon systems?
Trump has really embraced these characters. They're all over the administration, and Hegseth wants to run the Pentagon like a private equity firm. So these people have really installed themselves in the heart of state power.
Yeah, there's a long story to that. A lot of these tech guys got their foot in the door under Obama, you know, into the Pentagon, right? And Bill Parry advised Carter on like how to scale up, right? He said do it like a little bit at a time. Back when tech was more Democrat affiliated, they invited them into the Pentagon to try to remake it. Trump won, was a little bit mixed on that. Biden embraced the tech industry. He gave them a lot of what they wanted. They feel like not enough, but right, he gave Palantir Anduril contracts. He expanded the DIU program, right? They tried the replicator initiative. They went in on drones, especially toward the end. And then Trump has really embraced them. And they helped, you know, with Elon and others, right? They helped bring him to power. And they're staffing a lot of the Pentagon. Hegseth is making some policy, but Steve Feinberg, Deputy Secretary of Defense, was the CEO of Cerberus, which is this notorious private equity firm. These are interesting new deals, like the NVIDIA deal, the AMD deal. They're proposing to do the same with Lockheed, the MP Materials deal. These all sort of resemble private equity deals, and it's sort of a novel form of statecraft. It seems like an odd choice for how you might want to run the Pentagon.
And finally, as it turns out, you know, given these guys' critiques of the traditional defense contractors, their drones are not doing too well on the Ukrainian battlefield either. They're outdone by cheap Chinese drones. So they don't really seem to be delivering on their promises so far.
They're built to juice profits. They're really not built to produce things. They're not structured to produce things. They're not structured to do sort of long-term investment and the kinds of infrastructure building. Whether or not this is a good thing, we can sort of table, but to make weapons that work, that's not something that venture capital or private equity or the startup model is particularly good at. They're short-term vehicles, these imagined technologies, these imagined profits that are always on the horizon.
That was Susanna Glickman, Assistant Professor of History at Stony Brook and author of an article on the new military-industrial complex in the New York Review of Books. More on the balance of Riz and Tiz, Charisma and Autism, a duo made famous by Ariel Zuckerberg, Mark's sister and a tech venture capitalist. As she put it in the podcast in March, the Riz part is knowing if a person can recruit an amazing team, can they attract downstream funding, are they going to be a magnetic leader? And for the Tiz part, she said, we believe that neurodivergence is a superpower, and we look for people that live their lives differently. It represents an intensity and a directness. So we want a balance of both, and we think it kind of takes both to be an amazing founder. The key is to have the boldness to go after a really magically weird idea. Her VC firm, Long Journey, uses that phrase in a slogan, Chase the Magically Weird. Their values page dilates in that pursuit and illustrates it with an AI image of Bob Ross, an alpaca, and a dude dressed as a rat having a pizza party. That's the caption. Inspiring. What kind of companies does this philosophy lead them to invest in? Uber, Anduril, which declares its mission to be transforming U.S. and allied military capabilities with an advanced technology, and SpaceX, Elon's rocket maker. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Some of War, a 1994 song by those inscrutable ironists, Liebach. Till next week, bye.